Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Jordan Edwards, Communications Associate at the BJC. The 2015 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State were presented on the campuses of Mercer University in Macon and Atlanta, Georgia. This year's lecturer was Alan Brownstein, Professor Emeritus at the UC Davis School of Law. I'm here with BJC Executive Director Brent Walker. The Sheridan Lectures return to Mercer University every 3 years. It's sort of the home, so to speak, of the lectures. So Brent, tell me about the relationship Mercer University has with the BJC and with the Sheridan Lectures.
The Sheridans, Buddy and Kay, have been longtime friends of the Baptist Joint Committee, and of course, the last 25-30 years of their lives have been spent teaching at Mercer. So it really made sense when they endowed these lectures 12 years ago now to make it so that every third year they come back to Mercer. And so we accepted that stipulation gladly and think it's a great idea. They also still live in Macon, so whenever we come back, it's an opportunity to see the Sheridans and to thank them, and they can come and visit the lectures without doing any significant travel. They've traveled to most all of the lectures that we've had over the past 10 years, but it's a nice, you're right to refer to it as kind of the home of the lectures, and because it does give us an opportunity to see the Sheridans and spend some time with them.
One thing the Sheridans speak about when they talk about the Sheridan Lectures is that they wanted to leave a legacy that they could actually see in their lifetime. How important is the Sheridan Lectures towards the educational side of the Baptist Joint Committee's mission?
Well, I'm really glad the Sheridans decided to do that instead of waiting until they're gone, because they were able to give us the money, $100,000, which was an incredibly generous gift for two educators. They're not independently wealthy. It was so fitting for them to do it in their lifetime so that they could actually see the results of their generosity. And of course, long after they're gone, long after we're gone, that endowment will continue to provide income for Sheridan Lectures year in and year out. So the Sheridan Lectures are very important to the Baptist Joint Committee. We're committed to education. We're committed to reaching out to young people, college students and law students and seminary students. So it provides a way for us to do that each year as we've said, except for every third year at Mercer, to travel around from campus to campus to make that learning available to the students there.
Thanks, Brent. With that, here's the second of three Sheridan Lectures, titled The Multidimensional Nature of Church-State Controversies.
Well, if we look at contemporary debate in the United States on the pressing social and legal issues of the day, one thing seems very clear. The relationship between church and state remains a controversial and complicated question for the American people. No one could doubt that after the last 2 weeks. Some people seem surprised by that reality, however. What's the problem, they ask? Didn't we resolve these questions 200 years ago? After all, we're a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And surely that description applies to religious liberty and religious equality, as well as other forms of liberty and equality. And don't we have a First Amendment mandating that the government shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof? America is a place where people of different faiths and no faith get along pretty well with each other. What's the fuss all about? Well, part of that intuition is well-grounded. If we compare America to other countries around the world, we are a religiously pluralistic society in which people of different faiths do get along reasonably well. To give just one example, I'm Jewish, My wife is the daughter of a Methodist minister. Our son Ben was born in a Catholic hospital. The obstetrician was a Mormon. Maybe not only in America, but we would do well to remember that we have a lot to be thankful for in the way that our society deals with religious differences among our people. But that doesn't mean that we don't have serious problems that remain to be resolved. We assuredly do. But it's important to keep those problems in perspective. Many people around the world could only dream about the legal freedom and cultural tolerance that we take for granted. But we still have difficult, controversial issues to work through. It's important to understand that we didn't solve our social, political, and legal problems, which are grounded in religious differences, 200 years ago. Colonial America was far more homogeneous, far less diverse than America is today. In the 1700s, we were a Protestant nation. There were virtually no Jews, no Muslims, no Buddhists or Hindus. Indeed, there were very, very few Catholics. Mormons, Christian Scientists, Jehovah's Witnesses, they didn't exist yet as religions. Nor was colonial America a particularly tolerant society. Colonists may have come to the New World seeking religious freedom for themselves. They weren't always all that willing to recognize the religious liberty of people of other faiths. Protestant denominations were bitterly competitive with each other. America's society was virulently anti-Catholic. There was no respect whatsoever for Native American religions. The federal government funded missionaries to convert Native Americans to Christianity. But seeds were planted in the soil of colonial America that developed powerful roots. And these seeds, grounded in Protestant theology and Enlightenment ideals, and institutionalized, however imprecisely, in the Constitution, reflected commitments to religious liberty and religious equality and the separation of church and state. And as our society became more diverse, our understanding of these ideals became more sophisticated, and our commitment to religious liberty and equality became more expansive and more robust. This journey, however, was one of struggle and challenge. It hasn't always been linear and progressive. There are times when we stumbled and stumbled badly, and times we regressed. Looking back at American history, we can see that the way our society deals with religious differences is an ongoing work in progress. It's a work in progress that requires our continuous attention and effort to maintain what we have achieved and to move forward to resolve outstanding tensions and conflicts. A similar analysis applies to our understanding of the religion clauses of the First Amendment. The Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause do not represent static answers to questions about the relationship between church and state. Constitutional law involves a dynamic interaction between the wisdom of the framers and the collective experience of the American people over the last two centuries. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes once wrote about the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment, and I quote, "It's an experiment, as all life is an experiment. Every year, if not every day, we have to wager our salvation upon some prophecy based upon imperfect knowledge." And that observation is true for most of constitutional law, and it's certainly true for the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. We are a pragmatic society, continually testing traditional perspectives against modern conditions. Constitutional law tempers that process, but it's also very much a part of it. So we can certainly learn from our history and invoke constitutional principles in debating church-state disputes, but we can't simply assume that there's an answer to contemporary problems embedded in our past that will tell us how to resolve current disputes if we could only unearth it. Complete solutions to religious liberty and religious equality problems can't be discovered in our past. In part, they have to be created in our present. Still, there is a sense that even if we can't completely rely on history and constitutional law to provide authoritative answers to our questions, church-state issues shouldn't be that hard to resolve. After all, we're all Americans. We all believe in religious liberty and equality. We all agree that we should treat people who hold different beliefs fairly and respectfully. Or at least we say that all of that is true. But this intuition, I suggest, is mistaken, at least in part. And it's mistaken for several reasons. First, we need some sense of humility in examining our national character. A commitment to religious tolerance and mutual respect may be an important theme in the American narrative, but religious bigotry and hierarchy are also part of the American story. We have to acknowledge that we have met the enemy of religious intolerance, and as Pogo says, he is us. Second, support for religious liberty and religious equality values challenges powerful attitudes and presumptions. For devoutly religious individuals and communities, religious tolerance doesn't always come easily. As Ninth Circuit judge and church-state scholar John Noonan wrote, "It's easy to be tolerant if you don't believe. But for those who do believe that they know God's truth, the desire to suppress false representations and practices can be a powerful impetus to oppression." In addition, for some of the growing number of non-religious individuals in our communities, religious liberty is an unjustified privilege at best. At worst, it's a legal instrument that is just as likely to be employed as a sword to justify discrimination against others as it is to be used as a shield to protect minorities against discrimination. And third, protecting religious liberty and respecting religious equality requires an awareness of religious difference. And paying attention to religious differences requires effort. Well-meaning legislators may fail to recognize the impact of their laws on the religious practices of religious minorities. Thoughtful administrators and employers may plan schedules and activities that accommodate the needs of large religious constituencies in their community, but they don't take the time to identify the holy days and other constraints that limit participation by religious minorities. Also, there's a tendency on the part of majorities to equate their own beliefs with the natural order of things. Thus, the state's message affirming a religious principle of a majority faith may be understood by the members of that faith to be a simple and non-controversial statement of truth, and not an endorsement of a contested issue of faith. But adherents of minority religions will experience that message very, very differently. Fourth, and most importantly, some church-state issues grounded in religious differences are genuinely difficult problems for even the most well-intentioned society to resolve. Again, why is that the case? Why are these such hard questions to answer? If we're committed to the principle of separation of church and state, doesn't that tell us how church-state disputes should be resolved? Well, it does, and it doesn't. The wall of separation between church and state is a powerful and instructive metaphor, grounded on important ideas. The foundation of the wall is the recognition that government endangers religious liberty and equality when it interferes with or burdens religion, and when it promotes or subsidizes religion. In order for the government to avoid interfering with religion or promoting religion, it has to maintain a prudent distance from religion. The wall of separation between church and state is constructed to maintain that important distance between government and religion. But separation of church and state principles only take us so far. These are principles painted with a broad brush. And when we try to work out the height and the contours of the wall, we quickly discover that it's a wall of varying dimensions, and it even has some open doors and windows in it. The wall is a good starting place, but it doesn't provide a clear answer to many controversies and contemporary disputes. And one important reason for the difficulty we experience as a society in resolving church-state problems is that these issues are often complex and multidimensional. Because church-state disputes implicate so many important values, they cross conventional constitutional boundary lines. And while these values sometimes overlap, they are also sometimes in conflict with each other. And whenever multiple values are in play, it isn't going to be easy to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and come up with a clear answer as to how particular disputes should be resolved. Church-state disputes, I suggest, may involve four fundamental values that typically receive independent recognition and protection in our constitutional system. These values are personal liberty and autonomy, equality of treatment and of status, freedom of speech, and the diffusion of power. And let me spend just a few minutes explaining how each of these values relate to church-state disputes. Obviously, religious liberty, the ability to practice one's faith free from governmental interference, is an important personal liberty and autonomy interest. Religious liberty involves a vision of human dignity. It's grounded in a basic commitment to the right of individuals to make important self-defining decisions that are critical to the development of their identity, to the way that they choose to live their lives. We recognize and respect religious liberty just as we recognize and respect other essentially dignitary rights, such as the right to speak authentically or the right to marry. But liberty rights are often controversial and problematic. Rights can be very expensive political goods. Particular individuals or the public at large may pay a significant price if a right is exercised in a way that imposes a cost on third parties. To cite just one initially controversial but now generally accepted example, if we exempt a religious conscientious objector from military service, some other individual will have to go off to war in the conscientious objector's place, with all of the risks and burdens that military service in time of war entails. Whenever there's a price to be paid for protecting a right, there will be a debate about whether the price for doing so is too high. Much of the controversy surrounding the recent Hobby Lobby decision reflects that concern. The often heated discussions, very heated discussions, about whether states should exempt religious employers or businesses from civil rights laws that prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. Here also, the focus is on the costs of religious liberty accommodations to third parties. Now, church-state disputes also raise religious equality concerns. Religion does more than describe the beliefs of individuals. It also defines the identity of groups and communities. Discrimination against classes defined by religious affiliation, against Catholics or Muslims or Jews, is problematic for many of the same reasons that discrimination against classes defined by race, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation is troubling. Equality values are violated when majoritarian groups oppress historically victimized and vulnerable religious minorities, or exclude them from the public life and benefits of society. A commitment to religious equality also limits the state's promotion of religious hierarchy and status differentiation. Government can't use its power and resources to promote racial, gender, or religious hierarchy. The state must treat people of all faiths and no faith as if they are of equal worth and deserving of equal respect. Now, religious liberty and religious equality are very important values that are intrinsic to many church-state disputes. But we're not done yet. Church-state disputes also implicate freedom of speech. There is a speech dimension to many religious activities. Just think about them. Sermons, prayer, proselytizing, the publication of religious books and periodicals. And as an independent source of moral values, religion clearly plays a role in the marketplace of ideas. While freedom of speech serves important dignitary and autonomy values, we primarily protect freedom of speech to further instrumental goals, the search for truth, the effective functioning of our democratic system of government, resolution of public policy disputes. From the abolitionist movement of the 1850s to the civil rights movement of the 1960s to the debate about abortion today, religious voices have had a profound influence on American culture and policy. But the divergent voices of the different faiths and secular beliefs in our society will often express contradictory messages. Indeed, religious arguments have often been expressed on both sides of moral and political controversies in our society. So that's three values: liberty, equality, and freedom of speech. But there's one more. Church-state concerns raise questions about the diffusion of power. Our constitutional system is based on a deep-seated distrust of the accumulation of power. We fear that those with power will seek to aggrandize additional power. And we believe that all power will be abused. That's Constitutional Law 101. All power will be abused. And the attitude of distrusting power is in the very marrow of our constitutional and legal system. We don't trust government. We don't trust majorities. Basically, we don't trust ourselves when we have power, too much power. And because of this distrust of power, our political and legal system tries to diffuse and decentralize power. We try to create checks and balances so that different centers of power can operate to limit the abuse of power by other centers of power. We recognize that both the state and organized religion are centers of power in our society. Accordingly, we want religion to operate independently of the state so it can serve as a check on the misuse of government power. And we worry that when the state and religion are too closely aligned, become too dependent on each other, that this will centralize power, and like all centralized power, it has the tendency to be abused. Now, the separation of church and state mitigates this risk. But of course, this raises the question of just how much separation is necessary to further our diffusion of power goals. Now, the difficulty in resolving church-state disputes isn't simply that these disputes implicate several different values and interests, each of which is complicated in its own right. It's also that these values and interests often conflict with each other. And let me give you just two examples. Religious nonprofit organizations, NGOs, often provide social welfare services of various kinds to our communities. They operate soup kitchens, substance abuse programs, job training programs, homeless shelters, host of other programs. They do very, very good work in our society. Sometimes, certainly not always, But sometimes these religious organizations want to hire only people of the same faith to operate their programs. And accommodating this interest in working with co-religionists can be justified by religious liberty and institutional autonomy values. Religious liberty includes the authority to limit a religious institution's hiring decisions to employees of the same faith. But many of these programs receive financial support from the government. And if a tax-supported program discriminates on the basis of religion in hiring, its exclusionary policies can be challenged on the grounds that it is violating religious equality principles. Discrimination against religious minorities with regard to the availability of publicly supported job opportunities offends equality principles in pretty much the same way that discrimination against ethnic minorities or women or gays and lesbians offends equality principles. It reduces employment opportunities and it fragments the workplace along religious, ethnic, or gender lines. So we have two competing values here, religious liberty on the one hand, religious equality on the other. And resolving this issue, reconciling these competing values, it isn't going to be that easy to do. Let me give you one other example. Religious organizations, as well as many secular charities, receive very favorable tax treatment. Donations to these organizations, for example, are tax deductible. Most of you probably know that when you fill out your tax returns. But the government places conditions on this desirable tax treatment. Organizations receiving these tax benefits can't engage in partisan political activities. They can't endorse political candidates running for office. Now, some religious institutions raise objections to these requirements. When members of the clergy deliver sermons to their congregations, they argue, they should be free to express their beliefs and values, even if those beliefs and values involve the endorsement of a political candidate. And from a religious liberty perspective, what could be more central to the core of religious freedom than the liberty of clergy to express their beliefs from the pulpit during a worship service, free from government interference or constraint? Accordingly, some argue that religious institutions should be exempt from the prohibition against electioneering by tax-exempt organizations. And if we consider this issue from a religious liberty perspective, I think the case for religious accommodation is a powerful one. But what if we view sermons as speech? And of course, in a literal sense, a sermon is speech. And it serves the function of other speech in the marketplace of ideas. It promotes the values of the speaker. It's an attempt to influence the beliefs and conduct of the audience. And a sermon discussing political candidates could be fairly characterized as both religious and political speech. It's both. If we look at this issue from a freedom of speech perspective, an entirely different analysis applies. Religious and secular perspectives are competing viewpoints of speech. Exempting religious institutions from speech regulations that secular organizations have to obey constitutes viewpoint discrimination, favors religious speech over secular speech, and viewpoint discrimination is prohibited by the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment. So what appears to be a defensible and justified accommodation of religious liberty may also be an indefensible and unjustified regulation of speech. It all depends on whether we conceptualize sermons as the exercise of religion or we think about them as speech. But the hard reality of the matter is that sermons are both. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. A great deal of religious exercise is expressive in nature. And this means that the accommodation of such religious exercise is both justifiable from a religious liberty perspective and unjustified as viewpoint discrimination from a speech perspective. And to date, appellate courts haven't provided us any useful framework for resolving this problem of competing values between religious liberty on the one hand and freedom of speech on the other. Well, perhaps I've convinced you at this point that many church-state issues are hard to resolve. But that leads to an obvious question. So now what do we do? It would be a rather uninspiring conclusion to my talk to leave you with the idea that, well, some church-state issues are just hard to resolve. I can't really just stop there. I also can't end this talk by telling you that there's a way to make hard cases easy to resolve. For example, the two church-state cases that were decided by the Supreme Court last term, the Hobby Lobby case involving the contraceptive mandate, and Town of Greece versus Galloway, involving state-sponsored prayers before town board meetings, both of these cases raised complex issues that defy simple analysis or solutions. In Hobby Lobby, courts had to determine the extent to which a religious liberty right extends to for-profit corporations. That's a hard question to answer. They had to determine whether a regulation requiring an employer to provide health insurance to its employees covering certain contraceptives substantially burdened the religious liberty of the employer who viewed any complicity with the use of these contraceptives as sinful. That's a hard question to answer. And most problematically, courts had to evaluate the government's interest in adopting this regulation to determine if it justified the burdening of religious liberty interests. Was the price of protecting religious liberty too high? That's always a hard question to answer. In Town of Greece, the court had to determine whether the continued offering of exclusively and often explicitly Christian prayers before the beginning of town board meetings impermissibly aligned the town's government with Christianity. It's a hard question. It also had to resolve whether the offering such prayers by clergy who asked the audience to stand and bow their heads in prayer created a coercive environment that compelled residents who were about to petition the town board on public matters to participate in a religious exercise. Adjudicating this question and the other questions raised in this case involved competing complex liberty and equality values. Hard questions to answer. I can't transform these cases into easily resolved disputes, but I can recommend an approach we can take to discussing hard cases. We should resist attempts to oversimplify difficult church-state cases. And in our polarized polity today, it is far too easy to see only one side of a dispute and to ignore completely the interests on the other side. I thought both Hobby Lobby and Town of Greece versus Galloway raised serious religious liberty issues. By and large, however, liberals argued that the plaintiffs in Town of Greece raised important religious liberty concerns, while at the same time liberals trivialized the religious liberty interests of the plaintiffs in Hobby Lobby. And most conservatives did the reverse. They strongly supported the religious liberty claims of the plaintiffs in Hobby Lobby, and they disparaged the religious liberty interests at stake in Town of Greece. Both liberals and conservatives were willing to recognize and protect religious liberty when the cost of doing so would be borne by somebody else, when it didn't involve the loss of something that they cared about. Neither was ready to accept the principle that if we take rights seriously, we have to recognize and protect them, even if doing so requires us to sacrifice something of value, something that we value. I know it sounds something like a platitude, but we really have to work hard today to hear the voices of faith or of secular beliefs that challenge our predispositions. I've been writing about and advocating for religious liberty and religious equality for over 25 years now. And over those 2.5 decades, I've learned as much about these issues from my adversaries as I have from my friends. But you have to take the time and make the effort to listen. It's also important to understand that while some church-state problems will always be difficult to resolve, there are preemptive steps that government can take to mitigate church-state concerns and to promote the effective resolution of problems. From a political and legal perspective, government should understand that religious liberty deserves attention and protection. It's a basic idea. And what it means on the ground is that government should pay attention to the impact of its actions on religious liberty. If government is doing that, if it's paying attention to the potential impact of its actions on religious liberty, then it may be able to diffuse the intensity of some church-state disputes through an inclusive decision-making process. If people whose religious practices may be burdened are given a seat at the table to discuss their concerns, then compromises may develop that prevent disputes from arising that will be much more difficult to resolve once public positions have hardened. And a government that pays attention to religious liberty should acknowledge that burdens on religious liberty have to be justified. Trivial concerns don't trump the exercise of rights. Now, sometimes the price of protecting religious liberty will be high. It may be too high. Deciding what constitutes sufficient justification for burdening religious liberty in these circumstances will be a hard question to answer. It's a problem we confront whenever we attempt to balance the public good against the exercise of a right. But government should make it clear that it realizes that religious liberty should always count for something on the scale of constitutional values. Similarly, and again from a legal and political perspective, some religious equality problems can be tempered, even if they can't be entirely avoided. The basic equality principle here is also straightforward. I mentioned it earlier. Government should treat people of different faiths and no faith as if they are of equal worth and are deserving of equal respect. It isn't the government's job to determine religious truth or to rank religious beliefs or believers on some hierarchy of status or merit. And here again, disputes can be mitigated through an inclusive process of decision making. In the Town of Greece case, for example, the town board was conspicuous for its failure to even attempt to communicate with religious minorities in the community or to do anything else that suggested that it took religious equality principles seriously. The board assigned low-level functionaries the job of deciding who to invite to offer prayers at town board meetings, and it didn't provide them any guidance at all on how to make those decisions. That's an invitation to discrimination. The town also claimed that any resident who volunteered would be allowed to offer a prayer at the town board's meeting. Well, that's an open and generous policy, except it never communicated the policy to anyone, kept it to itself. Also, guest chaplains invited by the town to offer prayers before meetings were given no directions or instructions at all. And they typically expressed prayers on behalf of the town, its leaders, and the audience in attendance at meetings, rather than offering the prayers on their own behalf as personal prayers. Instead of this majority-centered approach, the town government could invite members of the community of different faiths and beliefs to the table to discuss how it can acknowledge the role of religion in our society without endorsing larger faiths or disrespecting minority religions or people who are not religious. Had the town of Greece done that, it might have learned, for example, that there's a significant distinction between what I call a we prayer and an I prayer. The former, a we prayer, presumes religious homogeneity rather than religious diversity, and it ignores the presence of religious minorities in the community. And for these religious minorities, a collective sectarian prayer consistent with majority beliefs is often unacceptable. It's a prayer that they can't join. I don't think it's disrespectful for a member of the clergy in a public setting to pray to God in her own name in terms that are meaningful to her own faith, even though these terms may be foreign to people of other faiths. But a sectarian prayer that purports to speak to God in the name of people of other faiths who are sitting in the audience, that's going to be experienced very differently. Government doesn't have the authority to speak to God in our names. Now, I don't believe it's difficult or intrusive for a town board to tell this to guest clergy that were invited to offer prayers at a town board meeting. They could be told that they're not empowered to pray in the name of a religiously diverse community, because that might well be experienced as coercive or disrespectful. I think this is a kind of compromise solution that might be agreed upon if people were invited to the table in order to discuss the issue. But compromises will never come to light if the majority makes its own decisions without discussing the matter with minorities in the community. And there are even more foundational steps to be taken to avoid or mitigate church-state disputes. Ultimately, if we want government to recognize and protect religious liberty and religious equality, we have to work to develop cultural support for these values. Over time, government actions will reflect the cultural predispositions of our community. Legal and political support for religious liberty and equality has to be grounded in the hearts and minds of the people. Ultimately, it all depends on us. And from a cultural perspective, a commitment to religious liberty has roots in the same foundation that underlies many other rights. And that foundation requires us to recognize the right of each of us and all of us to be wrong in the eyes of others. We have to recognize the right of others to express the wrong speech, worship the wrong gods, marry the wrong partners. And also, from a cultural perspective, a commitment to religious equality requires a commitment to living in a religiously integrated society. If we set up barriers that divide people of different faiths and no faith and prevent them from living and working together, we undermine the cultural foundation for religious equality. Ultimately, it is by interacting with each other on the job, in the neighborhood, in social settings, and in educational programs that we form bonds of empathy and mutual respect for each other. And we dispel stereotypes that taint and undermine our relationships. I really can't emphasize this last point enough. During the last 25 years, I've worked together with people of other faiths and no faith on countless academic, legal, and political projects. In all of those encounters, I've learned and benefited from my interactions with people of other faiths and beliefs. And I believe, at least I certainly hope, that they've learned and benefited from their interactions with me. And it's through these ongoing experiences with others who are different in some way from ourselves that a deep and secure cultural foundation for religious liberty and equality develops. I really don't think there's any other way. Thank you.
That was Professor Alan Brownstein delivering the Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State, recorded live at Mercer University. Thanks for listening to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. For more on the Sheridan Lectures, including videos of this and previous year's presentations, visit bjconline.org/lectures. For more podcasts, go to bjconline.org/podcasts.